The parable of the prodigal son is one of the first Bible studies that we ever learn as children. You know, we can go back to it over and over again and always get something new from it. We identify with it or think deeply about one of the characters or one of the details of the story. And how we do that often changes depending on our life experience, which means that this story becomes a part of us and a part of our Christian journey. Recently, I've been thinking a lot about the father in this story. You know, there really is nothing worse for a man to lose his son, or even someone that he just thinks of like a son. Whenever a parent loses a child, when we lose someone who's very close to us, it's just about one of the most heartbreaking things that can happen in this life. And when that person is not physically dead, there's no closure, because we agonize over what might happen and if that person may ever come back into our life. I have to confess that I both admire and struggle with the way the father in the parable handles this situation. I mean, what was it like for him when he watched as his youngest son left his house in such a state, obviously on the wide road that leads to destruction? How long was it between that fateful day and the joyful day of his return? Did the father go through Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief? Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance? Or did he just go back to work and get on with things? Was he prompted to do a deep examination of conscience over how he exercised the gift of fatherhood? And did that lead him to repentance and spiritual transformation? Did he exhaust his body with vigils of prayer and offer up sacrifices of penance and mortification in exchange for his son's conversion, return, and reconciliation? The gospel doesn't fill in any of those details, does it? And I can tell you right now that when I get to heaven, if I do, because I'll probably be turning the lights out in purgatory, okay, I want to go find that man and ask him a lot of questions, right? I want to ask him why he didn't do certain things. I mean, when the apple of his eye was departing for a life of dissipation, why didn't he grab him by the scruff of the neck, give him a kick up the backside, shake him, and say, "Stop acting like an idiot. You're going to ruin your life." Why didn't he schedule an intervention and get family and friends to love bomb the poor boy into wanting to stay? Why didn't he send out a search party or go himself to find him? Why didn't he lock the poor boy up in the house for his own good until the diabolical temptation to ruin himself passed? Now, the narrative doesn't tell us that the father failed to do any of these things, but all of the above seems to be rather a bit out of character. Maybe what he did do should be what we look at. Instead of indulging the curiosity of our questions of how we think he should have acted. After all, Jesus is giving us the story for us to learn from. So we should look at what the father does. The father stays in his house and waits. That's what I have the hardest problem with, because I can't imagine what he did with himself all that time and why he made the conscious decision to stay there. I struggle with the fact that the Father gave his Son half of his inheritance ahead of time and then let him walk away with it. And I confess that I get angry when I read this. I mean, you know, you're supposed to get an inheritance when your parent is dead. So the son has the nerve to go to his father with profound disrespect and basically say, "You know what, Dad? I wish you were dead now so I get this money and do what I want to with life. But you know what? Unfortunately, you're not dead. So can we act like you are and give me what I want anyway?" Wow. The Father has given his Son life and love and endless gifts, and this is the thanks he gets for it. But the Father gives the money anyway. It is the ultimate act of selfless generosity to give a gift that you know is unappreciated and will be squandered. It shows that the Father was detached from the material things of this world to such an extent that he freely sacrificed the fruit of his own hard labor, his own legacy, with no strings attached. Did the Father have the spiritual vision to see that this gift was actually an investment? One which would not be of capital to fund a future life, but proof of the most important resource any one of us can have: love. Human prudence would have told the Father to put the money in a fund or an endowment to protect the assets so that they could be used wisely later by a foolish young man when he finally grew up and started to act like a man with sense. But the Father freely gives something which was not really property or currency, but love. And the Father does this with such freedom and abandon. Also, we focus so much on the son's vices that we forget that the Father saw through and beyond them to his son's virtues. The Father saw beneath the dross of sin and shame that his son really was a good person and capable of great things. He trusted his son's goodness so much, and he trusted in God's infinite power to bring about conversion and reconciliation, that he waited in hope for his son to return. What a powerful lesson for all of us. How often do we focus so much on trying to root out what's wrong with other people, trying to fix them, that we fail to celebrate what's right with them? How often do we affirm the fact that they are not actually utterly depraved? I know some of our Calvinist Christian brothers and sisters think that we are, but no. But as St. Augustine described us all, capax Dei, capable of God. We know from the story that at a certain point, the son comes to his senses. Obviously, the young man's experience of his own misery, hunger, and loneliness was part of that. But could he have come to his senses at all if he had any doubt whether or not he could actually return to his father's house? Surely he had some sense of the character, the nature of his father, such that the only bright spot of hope in his life was just how much his father really loved him. And so he returns. While he was still a long way off, the father caught sight of him and was filled with compassion. That one word, compassion, not pity or regret, not shame or sorrow, the Latin word that means to suffer with. The father and the son were separated by an abyss of time and space, but they shared their sufferings together. And that compassion, that suffering with each other, bridged the gap and made reconciliation possible. He ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. There was no, "Son, we're going to have a chat about your little escapade here." There was no, "Why did you do this to me? How could you?" What there was initiative, encounter, closeness, and intimacy. And that made all the difference. We look at the father and see an absolutely amazing man. But he's not just someone we can admire from afar. Jesus offers him to us because, first of all, he is an image of God. The Father loves and forgives and waits for us like that. Return and reconciliation and restoration are possible like that. It is his example that we must follow. And you know, that doesn't mean that the prodigals in our life won't wander, sometimes very far. It doesn't mean that we won't feel sometimes like there are the seven swords of grief piercing our heart, like the Blessed Mother felt during the earthly life of her son. It doesn't mean that every story will end in slaughtering the fattened calf, because what is lost is not always going to be found, at least in this valley of tears. But there is one thing which is absolutely true. The Father has loved us. He tells us, as the father in the parable tells the elder son, "Everything I have is yours. Now we must celebrate and rejoice."